My wonderful task is to address the question of humanism. All of these words need to be defined well, I think, for us, if we're going to make sense of things. I appreciated what Oz had to say about the importance of language and the importance of definitions of words this morning, and I hope to address that term the same way, that humanism actually is worth spending a minute thinking about. We think we know what it means, and I'm going to hopefully give a definition that you will appreciate. Since we're here to talk about such a time as this, I thought this particular word would be worth talking about because it's such an idea that has such a tremendous influence in the world. And to start off, I want to tell you a story you may know. Perhaps you've heard of the story of Paris and the judgment of Paris. Eris, this goddess here, in Greek mythology, was not invited to a wedding. And that was a bad mistake because, you see, she is the goddess of strife and discord. And so not inviting her to the wedding was a bad move right off the bat. So what she did, maybe you know, is to forge a golden apple. And then write on the golden apple, "For the fairest." And then tossed that golden apple into the wedding party. And right off, of course, caused strife and discord. Well, Hera and Athena and Aphrodite each claimed this apple because each thought she was the fairest, you see. So they went to, when they couldn't agree, they went to Zeus. And, of course, Zeus is the king of the gods, right? He's the guy who should make these decisions. And said, "You decide which of us is the fairest." And Zeus proved his wisdom immediately by saying, "No way. I'm not tackling that in a million years." Partly because he knew what he was getting himself into, and partly because he knew that his wife was one of them, Hera. And Athena is his daughter. So, bad idea, right? So, what does he do? He says, "I know this shepherd guy in Troy. His name is Paris. And he's an honest fellow, you see. And if you go to him and let him judge, all will be well." So, the three ladies, the three goddesses, went to this young man, Paris, and they give bribes to him. They attempt each alone to bribe him into choosing her, you see. Athena bribes him with wisdom, says, "I can make you a wise man." And Hera says, "I can make you successful in battle." But Aphrodite, the goddess of love, says, "You know what I could do? I can give you the most beautiful woman in the world." And Paris, being a young man, said, "Let me think about it, okay?" And immediately he was given a woman called Helen. Maybe you've heard of Helen. And Helen was given to him as this, and in return he was given the gold. He gave the golden apple to Aphrodite. Of course, the other two were furious about all this, but never mind. It was done then. And just like with so many of these sort of tricks in the old mythology, Aphrodite didn't tell him the whole story. It turns out that Helen is already married to somebody else. Oops. Slipped my mind. But gave her to him anyway. What could go wrong? If you know the rest of the story, this is the Helen of Troy. When he abducts her, takes her off. Some people say she went willingly. Other people say that she was abducted anyway. At any rate, Paris grabs her, runs off to Troy. And, of course, her husband, Menelaus, is not exactly happy about this. And he goes to his brother Agamemnon and says, "Hey, you know what? We need to go and get my wife back." And he gets in his boat, and Agamemnon arranges for 999 other boats. You've heard of the face that launched 1,000 ships, right? And the result, of course, is that the Trojan War happens. Oops. Well, what my point in this is that it's very interesting that this judgment, this assessment of beauty in this case, but it could have been wisdom, it could have been truth, it could have been goodness, ethical behavior, could have been any kind of judgment, is accomplished, is done by a human being. Mind you, he was advertised as an honest guy, but you know the reality is he got bribed. Well, men make decisions and judgments, and often those judgments are guided by their own preferences and their own this's and that's, right? That's just how human beings are. And but my point is, it was assumed in the Greek culture that it's a normal thing for somebody called a human being, in this case, to judge goddesses. Where do you get that idea? Well, you get it from a pre-Socratic philosopher called Protagoras. Maybe you've heard of Protagoras. Oh, I have a picture. I forgot to show you a picture. This is a picture of Paris judging the three goddesses. And I actually looked for a long time to find one where the goddesses were dressed. If you know this subject in the art world, you know, Rubens painted it a whole bunch of times, but a whole lot of other people did too. And it was basically a great excuse, you see, to just paint the female nude. Well, I thought that would just distract from my point, so I won't include that here. But my point is that the idea that human beings judge things in the world, it comes from the Greeks originally. It comes from Protagoras, who was a little older than Socrates, and he's famous for having coined the phrase or the sentence, "Man is the measure of all things," and so judgment comes from human beings. You see. And so what I want to ask is, what does that exactly mean? Man is the measure of all things. So what I want to do is give you a little introductory definition here, and then I want to ask you about three different kinds of humanism. Talk to you about three different kinds of humanism. So what exactly is this? Protagoras gives us this first thing. He didn't actually say man is the measure of all things, but that's how it's been boiled down. What the original quote was is something like, the measure of all things is accomplished by man who decides what is and why it is, and what is not and why it is not. So it's a pretty all-encompassing concept. But what exactly does it mean for man to be the measure of all things? It could mean that man evaluates all things from his own perspective. After all, is there anything that man doesn't measure? Time, distance, efficiency, size, temperature, polling. We measure how far it is to the sun. We measure how far it is to the grocery store. We measure rates of return. We measure shoe sizes. We measure everything. Now that I think of it, we're always measuring things. So maybe the statement isn't so much about measuring as about who does the measuring. Maybe it's the stress is on man is the measure of all things. But who else but man measures, though? Right? I mean, I haven't seen the chipmunks in my backyard measuring much of anything lately. It's not done. So to say man is the measure of all things is maybe only to say man is the only one who measures anything. Well, I'm not sure that that's it either. The point is that there is someone else that does measure things, and that's God. And God surely measured when he created the world. Surely he measured when he measured more than material things, because he said, he looked at Adam and said, I judge that it's not good for you to be alone. So there was a measurement in a sense of his need, right? So God measures. So maybe the man is the measure of all things is simply the assessment of the difference between God measuring things and man measuring things. And we all know that after the fall, God and man differ on how to measure things. Well, That would seem to be the definition of humanism that we see on the American Humanists Association website. Let me see if I can get this up for you. It says this: humanism, yes, good, is a progressive philosophy of life that, without theism or other supernatural beliefs, affirms our ability and responsibility to lead ethical lives of personal fulfillment that aspire to the greater good. What a nice definition. Very clear. A progressive philosophy of life. Hence the ism part. You know about isms, right? Anything that's got a suffix ism on it is basically an ideology. We talk about reason being one thing, but rational ism is raising reason up to the point of being the summum bonum, the highest good. We talk about community or communes, but communism is a specific set ideological viewpoint that says we understand the world in economic classes and explain the world that way. The feminine is absolutely glorious, but feminism is a specific ideology that interprets the world through the needs and wants of the female, and so on and so on. Right? There are lots of them. Idealism is another one. Rationalism, I mentioned. This is humanism. It's not just humanity. It's humanism. By the way, the term comes from. I'll hold on to that. So it says, anyway, a progressive philosophy of life, which is an ism, right? Well, but it's a specific ism that says we're going to make sense of things without the use of theology or the supernatural. This is the AHA. But it also then goes on to affirm several things that are very interesting to me. Look at what it affirms. It seems to be in favor of the ability and responsibility to lead ethical lives. It talks about personal fulfillment. Interesting. It says that it aims for something called the greater good. What exactly are these things? Now, if this is to separate theism from humanism, if that was the goal, to separate the two from each other, then there's a conflict, obviously. Not just in the fact that they're two different approaches, but in their own logic, interior logic, because if they know anything about Christianity, it certainly talks about ethics. Isn't that one of the things that the Christian teaching is all about? I mean, we still have 10 commandments, don't we? Among others. So, ethical activity, leading ethical lives, is by no means unique to the humanist. Christian says the same thing. Personal fulfillment. That, too, is something that God speaks about openly and directly. He's interested in human fulfillment. John 10:10 says, Jesus says, I have come to bring you life, and that more abundantly. I want you to have a rich and fulfilled life. The God we serve actually desires that for us. Did you know that? I'm sure you did. But what about the third thing? The thing called the greater good. There's a good ambiguous and or vague concept for you. What is the greater good? Perhaps now we get to the nub of the issue, really. Everybody wants to find and be thought of as virtuous. Everybody wants to have a fulfilled life. Those things are human. Those are not just Christian or humanistic, as it were. But what about deciding what the greater good is? Man, maybe it means man is the measure of the greater good and not God. That somehow man knows better than God does what the greater good would be. So it may be. It may be that this is all a debate about who is the final authority to define the nature of goodness in any branch of our thinking. We'll come back to that in a minute. Does God intend for man to measure? If so, perhaps this doesn't have to be a head-on collision between the atheistic and the theistic approaches to human life. Christians teach that God gave Adam and Eve jobs to do in the garden, to name the animals, to cultivate the garden, to care for it, to bring it to fruition, to have and raise children, to subdue the earth. There's a lot of work that he called us to before the fall. These things surely require measuring. So maybe measuring is actually incumbent on us. It's supposed to be done. Maybe it's part of who we are supposed to be under God. So where's the conflict now? Well, somehow, we still want to differ with God about what is good and where we disagree. We want to side with man and not God. That's our bent. How did we get to this point? Well, it's the doctrine of the fall, isn't it? The fall explains it all. Man is made good. He's given stewardship over the creation, intending him to measure things. And then he decided he could do it without answering to anybody but himself. And that's how we did it. So man may be desirous of being the measurer of all things. But what I want to say at the outset is, while this AHA humanist approach is openly atheistic, openly anti-supernatural, I don't think that it's fair to say that the work of the human doesn't include being not only a measurer, but the measurer. Under God. Always under God. Do you see? So the distinction between a theistic approach and an atheistic one is who gets to have the final authority about what is good. But the idea, certainly we don't want to divide it like the Christians don't measure things and the materialists or the atheists or the humanists do. Not so. It's too convoluted for that. So what I want to do is give a more subtle sort of version of humanism here. I want to offer you three different kinds of, or three cases, or three versions of humanism. The first one is what I'll call classical humanism, in line with Judgment of Paris example I gave a minute ago. The second one I want to call Renaissance humanism. And the third, modern humanism. And then at the end of the whole talk, I want to ask two questions. And those two questions are these. How can the church best go about influencing the culture when the culture is predominantly thinking in line with this third kind of humanism, this modern humanism? And then the second question is, and a little more subtle, how is it that we can keep the gospel from being diluted by the culture around us that is assuming that kind of modern humanistic approach? Okay, that's our agenda. So let's dive into the history part of it. The Apostle Paul might actually be the first to combine both revelation and reason together. If you know I think I've even given the talk here before about how in Acts 16 he is guided to the west instead of the east, and he knows that he was prepared ahead of time to be the gospel, one to take the gospel to the Gentiles. Well, he combines those two things together because he was a student of Jewish law. He certainly knew the law well, and he was a Hebrew of Hebrews, he calls himself, but he was also studied in Greek rhetoric. And as a result, he was the perfect person to take the gospel to the Gentiles. But this kind of work of bringing those two things together in Western civilization goes on for the next, 1,200, 1,300 years, throughout the Middle Ages even. Starting with, you see it in the Church Fathers, you see it in Augustine when he addresses Plato, you see it in Boethius, you see it in others, you see it finally Aquinas dealing with Aristotle. So Aquinas died in 1274, so it was in the 13th century when he was dealing with Aristotle that was fairly new to the West. But all of that was an attempt to make sense of this Greek learning, Greek influence, from and through a Christian lens. Sometimes more successful than other times. But anyway, it was a job that the medievals and the early church felt was important to try and accomplish. And that job then fell the word that comes to mind for this kind of thinking is called the medieval synthesis. It was bringing two things together and trying to see them in a kind of harmony with one another. Well, the three great accomplishments of the High Middle Ages, I think, in doing this kind of work, are the Gothic cathedral, which is a combination of the vertical and the horizontal. You know your Gothic cathedrals. This Summa of Thomas that addressed Aristotle, and then finally the Divine Comedy of Dante, written in just around 1300. Now, sadly, late medieval scholasticism declined, becoming somewhat lost in the layers of commentaries on commentaries and so on. And in reaction to these, the call rose ad fontes, which means in Latin to the sources, to the source. And that, I think, is the beginning of what we might call Renaissance humanism, where the kind of humanity, the kind of work that humanity does in dealing with all aspects of human life, get judged through the lens of this 1400 years of Christianity that happened between the Greek Roman world and the end of the Middle Ages. Renaissance humanism, the second kind, emphasized human dignity, value, beauty, and potential for growth and good. And the two courses in the 15th and 16th centuries, the Christian and the classical aspects of this, separated, but they were run parallel to each other. You see it especially in the South, where there's a greater separation. I'm talking about the Florentine Renaissance and the Italian Renaissance. And there's a kind of equality of the two, and they're separated but equal. And they run parallel with each other, and there's a lot of back and forth amongst them. If you know the works of Boethius, you know that for a long time he painted, in the 15th century, painted a lot of mythological characters and subjects and told mythological stories, his famous Birth of Venus and so on, La Primavera, the springtime. But he was influenced by some Christians toward the end of his life, and he began to think, I need to start painting only a Christian subjects. Now, whether he was right or not to do that, it was an evidence of his internal conviction that he needed to be more on the side of the Christian than on the side of the pagan revival that was going on. You know what Renaissance means in French, right? Rebirth. And it's literally the rebirth of this great old Greek and Roman tradition, set of traditions and thoughts. In the North, classical learning and this call to ad fontes, this call to the sources, actually has an effect on the Christian way of thinking. They didn't just go back to pagan sources. They went back to the original Greek sources of the Old New Testament, and up until then had no translations of the New Testament in Greek until Erasmus came along and, as a Greek scholar, decided to retranslate the Bible into Latin, of course, but from Greek instead of from the old Vulgate Latin. And that was a bit of a shock to everybody. And that turned out to happen maybe 12 or 14 years or so before Luther wrote his German translation of the Bible. But he and Erasmus both, at least on this point, were sure they wanted to go back to the original languages and translate from there. And so that was a good aspect of humanism, if you want to think of it that way. It was a kind of revival of classical humanism that was Christian in its source, at its roots. In the North, classical learning and the call to original sources did this encouragement to write more profoundly about the study of the Bible. And Erasmus is translated, and you said, I said that. Disagreements over theology eventually separated Erasmus and Luther, as we know. But each man embraced this Christian humanism. That was what they called it, Christian humanism, with its reliance on original texts, its concern for ideas that were found in Scripture ahead of some church traditions, and the significance of the individual's relationship to God. All of those were part and parcel of this new way of thinking. Now, human life, I think, is of the highest importance to God, as I mentioned before. Irenaeus of Lyon, another leading theologian in the early church, second century theologian, wrote this, quote, "The glory of God is a human fully alive."
Isn't that interesting?
Well, let me show you a couple of paintings that I think illustrate some differences between the medieval approach and the new Renaissance approach. This is a painting, you may know, this is an altarpiece by a fellow called Duccio. Duccio painted this in probably 1308. And in it, you see, well, actually, this is a little bit further on than most medieval paintings, but it still has a lot of the characteristics. What you see is the Madonna and Child in the center, and then you see a lot of saints and angels all around them, and worshiping. But you'll also see something interesting about size. Do you see how large she is and how large he is in comparison to everybody else? Well, with our modern eyes, we wonder why those sizes are different. We try and make the smaller ones be further back in the painting and so on. You know, the bigger they are, the closer to the front they would be and so on. But there's no linear perspective in this painting. It's not linear. It's intended to be symbolic, as were most of the paintings of the time. The symbol is that Mary and the baby, Jesus, are to be considered more important. They're more significant, and that's why they're the size they are. In a sense, I mean, there are loads of things we can talk about this painting, and I don't have time to go to them all, but in a sense, though, this is a painting of a subject from God's perspective. This is, in a way, looking at the things the way God might look at them. Compare that to how this painting looks early part of the 15th century. This is a painting by a fellow called Masaccio. And Masaccio is an Italian Renaissance painter. Painted about 100 years later, 100 years after that Duccio painting you saw. And it's a biblical depiction of the scene from Matthew 17. The characteristics I want to point out are that, let me tell you the story first. The story is the tax collector, you can see, I think I have my trusty thing here. Can you see this fellow here with his back to you, very center, almost the center of the picture? That's a tax collector, and he's coming to the disciples, Jesus in the middle here, and saying, I need you to pay your temple tax. And Jesus, they say, well, we don't have any money. And Jesus turns to Peter, who's here with his arm outstretched, you see, and he says to him, go over there to the water and get a fish out of the water, and in the fish's mouth is this coin, and he says, pay the taxes with that coin. And so this painting is a little bit is a kind of narrative painting. It's not a single scene. It's a scene in the middle to begin with, but then there's a scene over here on the far left side where Peter is actually doing the fishing. You see, he's getting the fish out of the water. And on this side over here, on the right side, you see Peter on the left giving the money to the tax collector. This fellow here is the same guy as this guy here, his name. So this is a story picture. This is a depiction of a biblical story, but not so fast. The Renaissance was interested in more than just the biblical story. They were interested in the human aspects of it all. And so, Masaccio, there are lots and lots of things I could point out about it, but one of the things I want you to see is how it is that all of the heads are at the same height. You see that? They're all the same level. Now, he's bending over, but all these fellows. And you'll notice that there is linear perspective. You can certainly see it in this archway here and beyond it. There's a sense of depth. And there's even a sense of depth in the crowd here. You see some in front of others. But they're not different sizes. They're just different in space. They're one behind the other. This is a typical characteristic of Renaissance painting. You see linear perspective. But also you see this sort of evenness of all these heads. Many of the 15th century Italian paintings have that sort of thing. Why? Well, because this is a picture from man's perspective. This is looking as a human eye looks at things. If you look at the ceiling now, you'll see, in a sense, linear perspective in the ceiling tiles. The lines come together as they go further away from you. That's how we perceive the world. Well, this is an Italian Renaissance approach to a subject, and it's quite different, isn't it, than the Duccio picture, the medieval picture you saw before. So I think it's fair to say that, among other things, this is a transfer or an exchange or a change from God's view of things to man's view of things. If you know the famous, I won't bring it up, but you know the famous Leonardo Last Supper picture, where there are six disciples on one side and six disciples on the other one, and Jesus is in the middle and so on. And it looks like it's a biblical scene. It's not a biblical scene. It's using a biblical subject matter in order to say something else. And what it's saying is, look at each of the faces of these 12 disciples and see how they responded to the words that Jesus just said. And the words that he just said were, one of you will betray me. So it's a study in psychology. It's a human-centered, human approach to the nature of human beings. How do you respond to this? One of them is going, you mean me? Another one is going, did you hear what he said? And another one is saying, I can't believe it. And like that, there are all these different responses, and he has different responses from each of the 12. Judas, if you remember, is kind of holding his money bag and scowling like that. In the latter part of the 16th century, Shakespeare seemed to be able to write about all of the possibilities of human interaction in his 37 plays. And he did so within a Christian framework. In plays like King Lear, Hamlet, Othello, Merchant of Venice, Macbeth, The Tempest, as well as comedies and histories, he addressed such things as sin and forgiveness, authority and personal responsibility, but also character, love, magic, courage, mysteries of fate, honor, shame, jealousy, marriage, wisdom in fools, foolishness in the wise, giving us a vicarious window into our own lives and all of human experience. It's a famous book by Alan Bloom called Shakespeare and the inventor of the human. And it's just because he cataloged so many different ways that human beings could interact. Is that inherently unchristian? No. Is it humanist? Maybe so. You see? So we want a category called Renaissance humanism that allows for something called Christian humanism. And I'll come back to that point maybe a little bit later. If the North was offering essential reforms in the 16th and 17th centuries, the two elements of Christian faith and human reason were beginning to be pitted against each other. Not just parallel to each other, but pitted against each other. In the work of René Descartes and the following rationalists and empiricists, we find the seeds of what would become the so-called Enlightenment. A word that I think George Orwell would have been proud of. The Enlightenment, meaning just the opposite of what it is. Like the Russian propaganda magazine or a newspaper, Pravda. You know, Pravda in Russian means truth. Okay, well, whereas Christian humanism addressed the concerns of this life in light of eternity, the new secular humanism focused on earthly concerns only, the experience of beauty, truth, and goodness separated from transcendent points of reference or purpose. The key difference between Renaissance Christian humanism and this next one, modern humanism, or modern, some people call secular humanism, is not the embrace or rejection of reason. Let me say that again. The difference between Renaissance humanism and modern humanism is not the embrace or rejection of reason. Both sides reason. The difference is the starting point from which one reasons. Do we start with ourselves, as Descartes did, or do we start with God? The assumption of the secular humanist is that reason alone can lead us to the true, the good, and the beautiful for the good of society. Starting with the self, as an empty slate, man can recognize the right ways to go. On the other hand, the Christian humanist begins instead with God and reasons from Him. And the first thing we're told by God about man is that we were made good, but that we sinned, so that even the best of us is fallen. At the core of the definition of humanism is the question, are we basically good, or are we basically fallen? If we're basically good, then it seems like there should be no end to the good that man can achieve by the use of his reason. It's a kind of optimism about life. But if we're basically fallen, then there's no amount of reasoning that man can do to achieve genuine goodness. However, if we accept that we are fallen, then there's no end to the good that God can do through the redeemed man, motivated not by personal ambition, but for his gratefulness for his redemption, gratitude. Of course, the modern secular humanist approach elevates the faculty of human reason to the level of the summum bonum, the highest good, and leaves no room for the authority of direct revelation from God. This is modern humanism. So it's no surprise that the fundamental assumption of the Enlightenment becomes that we can define good without God. The Christian argues that we need to start with an axiom that is so obvious that it can't be denied, but can't be reached by reason alone, that man is sinful. It's taken on faith. We just know it is. For the secular humanist, the idea of taking anything on faith is anathema, since he thinks that to start with faith, it'll warp any of the work that you do from that point onward. So you can't found anything on faith and then reason about it, you see? You have to reason from the beginning, or it's going to be faulty. This is the humanist's approach. I was grateful again for Oz talking today about the difference between the American Revolution and the French Revolution, and bringing up Edmund Burke and Rousseau. My workshop tomorrow is going to be a discussion about those two, actually, because I'm going to talk about what Edmund Burke called the moral imagination, the Christian imagination, as opposed to the idyllic imagination, the imagination that Rousseau embodied so well. So if you want to dig into that further, come see us tomorrow. Let me give you a... Oh, I was going to make a mention about how it's not at all strange to start with something that you take by faith. For the secular humanist, the idea of taking anything on faith is anathema, I said, right? But it's not without precedent that we start with faith in self-evident truths, axioms, and so on. Euclid certainly did that with geometry. You can't do geometry unless you start with some axioms, things that are taken without proof. The Declaration of Independence, founding a government. We said we find these truths to be self-evident. There are certain self-evident truths. And I want to quote you G.K. Chesterton here, who speaks about the problem of reason and how we have to found reason on something other than reason. What he says is, the whole secret of mystery is this, that man can understand everything by the help of what he does not understand. Typical Chestertonian line. He can understand everything by the help of what he does not understand. The morbid logician, on the other hand, the rationalist, seeks to make everything lucid and succeeds in making everything mysterious. The mystic allows one thing to be mysterious and everything else becomes lucid. That's how it works. And if you know orthodoxy, he says at another point, the poet is the guy who understands these things, not the mathematician, the sort of logician. He says the poet only wants to get his head into heaven. The logician wants to get heaven into his head, and it cracks his head. Reason on its own can manage to reach nearly any conclusion that it wants. So we need something to found reason on. Do you know the story about the man who believed he was dead? Have you heard this? He thought he was dead, and his wife tried everything she could to convince him that he was not really dead. He was alive, and he kept saying, no, 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 I'm sure, I'm dead. So she came up with an idea. She said, do dead men bleed? And he said, of course not. Dead men are dead. They don't bleed. So she pricked his finger and he started to bleed. What do you think now? She said. And he looked at his bleeding finger and said, well, what do you know? Dead men do bleed. You see, you can, once you've decided where you're going, you can get there with reason any way you want to. Eventually, though, the two sides of faith and reason come to blows in the 18th century in what we call the Enlightenment. One side included thinkers like John Locke and later Edmund Burke on the side of retaining a kind of Christian humanism in a way that Burke called the moral imagination I mentioned to you. On the other side, you have Diderot and Rousseau and Voltaire and finally Immanuel Kant on the secular humanist side, and Burke called them the idyllic imagination. Now, my workshop tomorrow is going to cover that, so I'm not going to go into it here. Each made use of the traditions of humanism to write and critique each other's writings, but they disagreed on the major point of the authority of God. Burke argued for what he heard as what he considered traditionalism, or conservatism, Rousseau for what he was considered progressivism or tolerance at the time. But the issue was not to trust or not trust the established centers of authority. That was the key. Namely, the church and the aristocracy. And it was Kant who claimed in 1781 that it is human understanding alone that generates our notions of God and morality, freedom, and purpose. Kant wrote, our age is the age of criticism, to which everything must submit. Religion, through its holiness, and legislation, through its majesty, commonly seek to exempt themselves from this kind of criticism. But in this way, they excite us just suspicion, he says, of them against themselves, and cannot lay claim to that unfeigned respect that reason grants only to that which has been able to withstand its free and public examination. Everything has to come under the human judgment. Everything. Now, Kant's purpose was not to overthrow the authorities he questioned, I don't think, but to reinforce their position by showing the reasons for them. He was convinced that society would only progress and become more moral and reasonable as time went on. But on this point, of course, he was terribly mistaken. Before the decade was out, the Bastille had been stormed, and within 12 years of his critique of pure reason, the reign of terror had begun. And the very authorities he thought he was saving were guillotined. Because it wasn't only the aristocracy they wanted dead, it was the church. The utopian aspects of the idyllic imagination, no longer limited by the moral teachings of the church, inevitably led to a diabolic imagination that always encourages indiscriminate violence, overthrow of all authorities without regard for what might replace them. Diderot supposedly wrote, man will never be free until the last king is strangled with the entrails of the last priest. How's that for a striking word? Even if it's not exactly the wording, some people disagree that he actually said it that way. He said something very similar. But it summarizes this diabolic rejection of all authority for the authority's own sake. If you're standing in the way of the will of the individual human, you're wrong, and you must be gotten rid of. So, actually, Kant and Diderot, and most especially Rousseau, set the table for the Romanticism of the 19th century. Romanticism is a rejection of the all-encompassing claims of reason, but not at all a rejection of the assumptions of secular humanism. In fact, it was the assumptions of Rousseau's idyllic imagination that inspired all the Romantics. Man is a blank slate at birth, he said, and all the evil and difficulties that he experiences come from the authorities, institutions, and oppressive cultural expectations of civilization. It's civilization that stands in our way of being free. Later in the century, Paul Gauguin the painter would leave his wife and children and travel to Tahiti in hopes of escaping what he thought was a stifling Paris society that was immoral for a richer, purer, primitive life in Tahiti. Let me give you another couple of paintings to show you what I'm talking about. This is a painting by Jacques-Louis David. David was a painter in the latter part of the 18th century, early part of the 19th century, and he painted this Oath of the Harati, it's called, in 1785. 4 years, just 4 years before the storming of the Bastille. And it tells the story, at the time well known, of a family of brothers swearing to defend Rome and conquer or die. That's what they're saying. A symbolic representation of the cause that David himself joined to overthrow the French aristocracy with the commitment that these fellows showed. This is clearly an old Roman story. But the neoclassical 18th century drew on this old Roman story, brought it into the present day, and used it in a sense as propaganda. So, this was to teach no more fooling around. This is no more putting up with the extravagances of the ruling class. Just apply human reason, and our cause is just. Step up, and promise yourself to this great endeavor. Well, not 12 years later, the Spanish painter Goya, artist Goya, did this etching. And this etching, may be hard to see, but the Spanish is actually written on the side of the desk that this fellow is asleep on. And in Spanish it says, "The sleep of reason produces monsters." And it was a satire and a genuine finger in the eye to this whole rationalism of the 18th century, this optimistic rationalism. Goya was saying, yeah, reason may do a lot of good things, you see, but when reason falls asleep, things that are mysterious and don't make any sense happen. And if you see the fellow, he's at his desk there, and he's fallen asleep, and these are all nightmares in his back. Bats and cats and strange animals haunting his dreams, you see. Reason has to sleep sometimes, Goya would say. And when it does, we're confronted with elements that reason can't explain, like love and hate and passion and power and dreams and death. The church and Christian thought were still around in the 19th century, and their influence was reflected in the arts. In the later work of Wordsworth, for example. The music of Mendelssohn and Brahms, you know, because Wordsworth at the beginning was very optimistic about the revolution and so on, and he wrote his prelude in favor of a lot of kind of pantheistic sort of approach to nature and so on, religious experience through nostalgia and various other things. But by the end of his life, he was going back and rewriting the prelude and putting in specifically Christian imagery in those various places. He realized that what he had been for hadn't worked very well. But you also can find a Christian influence in the work of Mendelssohn's music, for example, and Brahms, and the novels of Dostoevsky. Even Wagner felt some need to re-engage Christian thought with his final opera, Parsifal, which is a medieval tale about the search for the Holy Grail. It was kind of a side connection, a tangential relationship to the Christian faith, but never mind. But the genie was out of the bottle by that time, and progressive writers and thinkers like Marx and Engels and Darwin and Freud and finally Nietzsche pushed the boundaries of this secular humanism in the direction that it went into the 20th century. Let me give you another example of a painting, this one by Gustave Courbet, who is what they call a realist painter. This was painted not too long after 1948, and you know 1848. 1848 was a very important year because it was the year that Marx published his Communist Manifesto and tried to explain to everybody how it is that the communist view of life made sense of everything in purely economic terms. The middle class is being oppressed by it's doing the oppressing of the lower class, right? And in a sense, it's the same spirit, I think, as the French Revolution that says the aristocracy is oppressing everyone else. And mind you, they were in many ways. Okay, I'm not defending them, but that was the case. You make the aristocracy and the church or the authorities the oppressors, and then you say all evil comes from them, and then you can justify destroying them. Marx, in the same way, called for the workers of the world to unite and step up and stop the oppression of the middle class, the bourgeoisie. Well, this is a painting called The Stone Breakers. And it's a departure from the kind of romantic painting that went on in the first 30 so years of the 19th century. This was painted, as I said, just after the Communist Manifesto came out in 1848. So this is probably 1849, 1850, something like that. And you'll notice a couple of things. It's a depiction of manual laborers breaking stones. They're backs to us. They're dressed very shabbily. And they're up against a dark hillside background that kind of isolates them from even the sky. There's a little touch of sky on the far right upper corner there. But the rest of it is kind of an oppressive background. They seem trapped. They're not romanticized in their condition of suffering like you might see in a typical romantic painting of Géricault or Delacroix or somebody like that. They're chosen rather because they represent a particular class of people. They're lower class, working class people. They're trying to break rocks and get them out of the way to make a road. And there's one, that's the reason that their faces are not important. If you take a look at it, you'll notice that you can't see anybody's eyes. You can't see their faces really. You see a little profile of the one on the right. The guy on the left has his face almost completely turned away. It's because they're not individuals anymore. They're members of a class. Courbet is responding to this new Marxist interpretation of the world into economic classes. And the result is a style that rejects both the neoclassical rationalism that you see in paintings like David's portraits like this, or that David we saw before. Very neoclassical, very crisp lines, lots of bright light, fairly even light. Very detailed. Every detail is very important. Very balanced and symmetrical and at rest. Typical recreation or reenactment of the kinds of Hellenic art that you see in the statues in the 4th, 5th century BC. Neoclassical art. But neither was it like a romantic painting like this Géricault. Maybe you've seen this at the Louvre. This is called the Raft of the Medusa. And it's a terrible, terrible moment of these people on the, having spent weeks on a raft in the open ocean, and some of them are dead and some of them are dying and they're very sick and fairly hopeless, and it's a very emotional moment. It's a very powerful emotional moment. But the Stone Breakers is different than either of those. Marx and those who followed offered substitutes to explain the human condition without God, because now they're committed to it. Marx offered this materialist explanation I was telling you about. Darwin offers a substitute creation story. Freud gives an explanation of our inner life and emotions. Each dutifully does so without reference to God. But finally, Schopenhauer and Nietzsche and Heidegger will insist that we should face the facts head on. If there's no God, then we needn't create a substitute. We should live honestly without an explanation. That all attempts to offer a substitute for God are a kind of cowardice. We're not actually looking reality in the face any longer. Nietzsche wrote this: I praise, I do not reproach nihilism's arrival. I believe it's one of the greatest crises, a moment of the deepest self-reflection of humanity. Whether a man recovers from it, whether he comes master of this crisis, is a question of his strength. If man is strong enough, he might be able to handle looking into the depths of nihilism. Now, there's some argument to be made that Nietzsche never really intended nihilism to be his end goal. He knew very well that nobody can actually live in nihilism. He seemed to think that we had to embrace nihilism in order to get to something beyond it, beyond good and evil, in order to get past to a new societal foundation of some kind. And in doing this, one would say that Nietzsche was the first 20th century existentialist, I think. But all within the context of this idea that humans are the ones that make the decisions. Humans are the ones that evaluate things. And his evaluation was that, logically speaking, we had no place to go but here. And this, I think, is the end of secular humanism. This is where it stops. What you find in Heidegger and on into the 20th century is an attempt to find an alternative to humanism, in a sense. But we're not going to talk about that. Once God is removed from the equation, human life is flat. It has no more meaning any longer. Nietzsche and Heidegger both knew that if the world indeed had come to the point where the influence of the biblical God was gone, then we should be prepared for the bloodbath and raw power unencumbered by Christian ethical moorings that was going to come. And sure enough, in 1914, it came. Mass death for the first real time. The invention of the machine gun, the invention of the mustard gas, where you can kill many, many people at once. It came in Russia in 1917. It came in 1936 in Spain. It came in 1939 in Germany and Japan. 1946 and 7 in China. In the 50s in Korea. In the 60s in Vietnam. In the 70s in Cambodia. In the 80s in Central America. And even though the Soviet Union fell starting in 1989, the echoes of it are still heard today in Africa, in South America, and even parts of our own country. In the 20th century, after Heidegger, those that follow embrace irrationality. But Renaissance humanism has continued to influence the 20th century. I mean, Renaissance, that is Christian humanism, has continued to influence the 20th century in the works of people like Chesterton and Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and T.S. Eliot, Flannery O'Connor, Walker Percy, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Russell Kirk, Henrik Gorecki, Dana Joya, Arvo Pärt. All of them have had a great influence in our century. Now, their works show how the Christian faith can serve to explain and give foundation to human experience founded on the essential teachings of special revelation. These have written nonfiction books, but also histories and poetry, short stories, epics, operas, symphonies, and children's books that have had a tremendous influence. Here's a painting by a Christian painter called Georges Rouault. Do you know Rouault? This is called The Three Judges. Rouault was a Christian, and this painting expresses his skepticism about human judgment. He's quoted as saying, "If I have made judges such lamentable figures, it's doubtless because I betrayed the anguish which I feel at the sight of a human being who has to pass judgment on other men. Maybe the very nature of passing judgment on other men autonomously is a burden that humans are not supposed to have to carry. The judges themselves," he says, "I couldn't condemn." But secular humanism has also continued to offer a utopian optimism about the nature of human being and influence the 20th century with it, thinking that man can overcome all obstacles and injustices, ugliness and lies by simply exercising his reason, unfettered by Christian or any other religious experience. And that's, we've made full circle back to that AHA definition. There were three versions of something called the Humanist Manifesto in the 20th century, well, close to the 20th century, over 70 years, 1933, revised in 1973, and then again in 2003. The 1933 version is a little more optimistic about the future of life under secular humanism. But having seen what happened in World War II, the 1973 version is a little bit less optimistic. Signers of the various versions include some of the most famous people in the 20th century. John Dewey, Anthony Flew, Julian Huxley, Isaac Asimov, B.F. Skinner, Oliver Stone, the movie director, Kurt Vonnegut, Francis Crick, Richard Dawkins. The American Humanist Association's motto, you'll recall, or maybe I haven't told you, but on their website, in their logo, it says, "Good without a God." Humanism is a progressive philosophy of life that, without theism or other supernatural beliefs, affirms our ability and responsibility to lead ethical lives of personal fulfillment that aspire to the common good. In this way, the AHA seems like it's an embrace again of Kantian rationalism, forgetting all the things that have come on between Kant and us, rejecting anything that offers transcendent or supernatural assumptions, and in so doing, seems to be either ignoring Nietzsche's concerns or embracing nihilism, and simply embracing rationalism on top of nihilism. in spite of the fact that they know it's not true. One or the other. The alternative to the kind of painting that Rouault painted in its own style that I haven't talked about, but it's a style that is very abstract in some ways, is the painting of somebody called Piet Mondrian. If you know Mondrian's work. This is Mondrian. Modern humanism eventually leads Mondrian to seek a Unitarian-like wholeness to the world. Some kind of universal truth to take the place of the God that we've rejected. All the material world can be reduced to basic elements. All curved lines are nothing but combinations of vertical and horizontal. All colors can be reduced to the three primary colors. And black and white are the extremes of all shades in between. Perhaps a reduction of elements to their absolute essentials could give us a universality of human experience. Here's what he said about it. If the universal is the essential, then it is the basis of all life and art. Recognizing and uniting with universal, therefore, gives us the greatest aesthetic satisfaction, the greatest emotion of beauty. The more this union with the universal is felt, the more individual subjectivity declines. You see, what he was after was a substitute for God. God is the one who gives perspective to all things. And so, in a sense, to see through God's eyes, see the world through God's eyes, gives us meaning, gives us understanding, gives us intentionality about our actions. It gives us ethics and so on. But without that God, Mondrian needed something else. He needed some way to have a universal objectivity, something that was true for all people. And what he thought was that he could reduce all of our vision down to those bare essentials, those universal things. But you see what happens, don't you? The delight of diversity disappears altogether in this kind of logical, like Chesterton was talking about, logical order to everything. It's a kind of madness, in a sense. Okay, I better wrap up, but I want to wrap up with these two questions. First, what can we do? What can we do as a church, as a Christian, to be influential in a world that still thinks very much in the majority about in terms of Christian in terms of, sorry, let me say it all again. What I'm trying to do is say it too fast. I want to be able to figure out what the church can do to have an influence on a culture that is predominantly secular humanist. How can we do it? Well, first thing is, when somebody says, can't we be good without God, like the AHA website asks, we have to deny the question. Well, we have to show that the question is meaningless. And it's meaningless in two different ways, either way. If you say that goodness is defined by God, that God himself is what goodness is, then the question is completely meaningless, right? Because it's really saying, can't we be like God without God? Can't even know what goodness is if that's the case. But the humanist would tell you, but I don't believe that. I separate the two things. I say you can be good somehow and God doesn't have any part in it. Well, in that case, it really doesn't make any sense, because in every way, we're asking, well, in the first way, you're saying, can't we be wet without water? Well, that doesn't make any sense, right? But if there's no connection between any kind of understanding of God and goodness, then what you're asking is, can't we be good without a bicycle? Why ask the question? There's no connection there. There's no reason to describe it that way. For thousands and thousands of years, we have said that the definition of God includes goodness. And so to be good is to be like him. Okay, but there's a second way I think we can be influential, not just on the sort of logical level. And that is that we might influence the world by showing how the Christian truth actually gives the humanist more of what he's looking for than he can get any other way. The reality is that they really do want to have fulfilled lives. And you can't have fulfilled lives if the reality is that you're made to be with God and you've separated yourself from Him. There's just no way to do it. It's a very momentary happiness if they do. So I want to argue, and I won't make the case here, but I want to argue that we can speak through our art, like the ones I've been giving you, of the ideas that give a rich and multifaceted understanding of our relationship with God, what it means to love His faithfulness to us, and our call to be faithful to Him. But secondly, I want to say we need also to be careful not to allow the gospel to be diluted by the secular humanism that we see around us, the modern humanism we see around us. We need to see let me put it this way. In every problem, you have to diagnose the problem and then you have to treat the problem. And in our case, I think what we do is we associate the influence of the humanist is to associate the diagnosis of the problem and the treatment of the problem so closely together that we can't actually separate them from each other. And that disallows for the Christian answer to a problem. In other words, we can agree with the humanist that there might be a particular problem in the world. A wrongdoing, an injustice, for example. We might agree. But we might disagree about what the treatment for that injustice should be. And I can promise you we're going to do that if we're not going to let Jesus tell us how it is that we should respond. For example, if he tells the parable about the man who says, I'm going to throw my brother in jail because he owes me $20, and I just came from the king and I owed him $20 billion, and he forgave the whole debt. Do you remember that parable? You remember that parable? Well, that's radical. We think if somebody owes us, he owes us. And that's the end of that. But we've forgotten how much we've been forgiven. The radical nature of the Christian response to injustice in the world is forgiveness. It's prayer. It's treating the other guy as though he were a sinner just like me. Perhaps the argument is that there's evil in the world, and we agree, but we can associate so closely the treatment that seems fair and just, but is opposite of what Jesus would have us do. Jesus says, I know you've been told an eye for an eye, right? And a tooth for a tooth. That seems reasonable. But what I tell you is this, and then he tells you these radical things like love your enemies and pray for your persecutors. Forgive your brother 70 times 7. That's not reasonable. G.K. Chesterton said this. A sensible pagan would say that there were some people one could forgive and some one couldn't. A slave who stole wine could be laughed at. A slave who betrayed his benefactor could be killed and be cursed even after he was killed. Insofar as the act was pardonable, the man was pardonable. That, again, is rational and even refreshing. But it is a dilution. It dilutes the truth. It leaves no place for a pure horror of injustice, such as that which is in a great beauty in the innocent. And it leaves no place for a mere tenderness for men as men, such as the whole fascination of the charitable. Christianity came in here as before. It came in startlingly with a sword and clove one thing from another. It divided the crime from the criminal. And that's what I'm arguing for. The criminal, we must forgive unto 70 times 7, we're told. The crime, we must not forgive at all. It was not enough that slaves who stole wine inspired partly anger and partly kindness. We must be much more angry with theft than before, and yet much kinder to thieves than before. There was room for wrath and love to run wild. And the more I considered Christianity, the more I found, while it had established a rule and order, the chief aim of that order was to give room for good things to run wild. sometimes I think we think that the wrong that's been done, the injustice that's been done is so heinous, so awful, that we have to dramatically treat it. And something inside of us says, well, wait a minute, maybe that dramatic treatment is too strong. And we're stuck with this dilemma because we think the two go together. We don't want to be quite that strong, so the answer is to sort of look the other way about the sin, you know, to make it less important. Maybe he wasn't quite such a bad thing after all. Well, that's a mistake. The two of them actually have to be disassociated from each other so that you can be nailed to a cross and at the same time say, Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. You see? That's the radical gospel. And if we reduce the gospel in our understanding of justice, then what we've done is we've taken away the very salt and light that we have to offer. I think there are things that are too grand for us to consider, and I want to close. Oh dear, I'm running out of time. I've got to play this little piece of music for you. It's only 4 minutes, but it's the statement of Psalm 131, and I'll play it for you in hopes that it will work. It's not working. Oh no. What's the problem? Ah, here we go. It is working. There we go. What's going on? It should be playing right now. There we go. This is in Hebrew. This is... Listen to this. Two lines. O Israel, put your hope in the Lord. from this time forth, and forevermore. And then they repeated, O Israel, put your hope in the Lord. And the mystery of it all, harmonically speaking, and the soprano reaches up higher and higher and higher into heaven, and we're home. And to finish the piece, he gives us just the first verse of Psalm 133. All a cappella, behold how good and pleasant it is. Brothers dwell together. In unity. And here's the unity. Open octaves. And then all they have left to say is Amen. We're meant to leave our study of the good and the evil to God. Allow Him to be the judge and follow Him. Maybe we shouldn't have eaten that fruit. See? That's where it all goes back to, doesn't it? You've been very patient and I've gone over time. Thank you all very much.
So we have room in the program. Obviously, we have to judge going late very, very harshly, but be very gracious to the sinner.
You listen!
Isn't that what we just learned? And we can combine the two in the grace of the Lord and an expandable program. So we're going to go another 10 minutes and have some Q&A just to let that music sink in. Wasn't it wonderful? Give John a chance, and some folk who might have some questions, you can come to the mic. Now we'll go another little 10 minutes, and then we'll just push the workshops back 15 minutes, and we still have some time to have a good evening meal together. So any questions for John?
Hi, my name's Brian Swenberg.
Hello.
When are we going to have a choir? At the Libri Conference.
Yes. Yes. Wouldn't that be nice?
Well, this evening, everyone's the choir.
That's right. You'll be the choir tonight. Come and let's sing together. Anybody else? Maybe we've done it all. Yep. Oh, okay.
John, thank you. It's always a delight. I love your pictures.
Oh, the paintings, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. So did them in the back room. I just painted them myself.
Ozgenis did a lovely job this morning about sort of lifting our heads to the heritage that we have from biblical principles that are so often degraded around the world today, especially by the liberal agenda. So you did a beautiful job there, and so did you as well. But I would like to hear a response that might balance some of this, because some people might come to this conference and hear a call to culture war. I taught a class on religion and culture, and there's some truth to the fact that it's like, may the best ideology win. You know what
right,
I'm saying?
Right.
And yet, a call to culture war, it can lead down paths that we really don't want to go down. You know, a sort of Constantinian triumphalism.
Right.
That throughout history, when Christians have dominated through the power, it's never ended well.
Right.
And people have pointed out that a religion, perhaps like Islam, is really designed to dominate from the top down. But Christianity, the Christian gospel, is designed to actually succeed through suffering and sacrifice. And so what I would like to hear from you is how do we go forward, that if domination does not end well, and if we are called to suffer and sacrifice, that, you know, that's not a very fun thing. But I'm going to just kind of throw this ball to you and let you run with it. But I think what you've given me in ending here is a may the best ideology win through beauty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that even through the suffering and sacrifice, we are going to do the best that we can at giving an ideal of human flourishing, and in the end, it is the most beautiful and thus compelling.
Right.
I don't know. Can you?
That's exactly what I would say, that it's more compelling. But the goal of crafting art, crafting culture, and so on, is not in order to sort of stick your finger in the eye of the other guy. That's never the intention, right? The Christian understanding is that culture actually just comes out of us naturally. This is something we do. We're human beings. We make. We're homo faber. We make things. What I think the church has often done is decide the goal is to cut down what other people make. And the criticism of that gets to be quite polemic and quite ugly and so on. What I'm arguing for is a genuine love of beauty amongst Christians and a love of our humanity. This, when I talk about humanism, I really don't like the word humanism even, because it's an ideology. What I want is a word like humanitas, something that is the study of the human condition, of all aspects of human life. That's an old Ciceronian word. That's the Latin version of the word paideia. Do you know the word paideia in Greek? It means a kind of an educational approach, a kind of a system of education. And so human beings should be thinking in Christian categories about life, and as we think about those things, we simply create things. We make nice living room furniture. You know, we make certainly music and paintings and poetry and so on. And I would much rather that we craft what we know to be good and beautiful and right, and simply lay it out there, a positive thing in this world, rather than spending a lot of our time trying to criticize and fight with those who make things in other ways. Because I think your last point is excellent. That is that it's more compelling. It's going to be more beautiful. It's going to be more compelling. It's going to build community better. It's going to reduce the amount of bitterness people have in their hearts about life and so on. It's going to have that effect, I believe. I mean, it certainly has in the past. So, yeah, I'm not in favor of this whole sort of culture war mentality where we're too ideological. Christianity is not an ideology anyway. Right? So we're not, it's not like we're not fighting an ideological battle that way. We're simply living out our faith in leaving the consequences to God. It's a much, much more beautiful, I think, thing. And that's the way he's told us. I'm not making this up. This is, I think, the way he's called us to. Great question. Anybody else have a question? All right. You've been very, very kind. Thank you all very much.
Thanks, John.